Welcome to This Is Money. I'm Georgie Frost, and alongside me in editor Simon Lambert today is assistant editor Lee Boyce. And under 2 weeks to go until the general election, as promised, we are going through the manifestos in more detail now. You got a bit of a teaser last week, but we didn't have all three from the major parties. We do now. So the team have been busy scrutinising them to find the most important pledges affecting your finances. And they've highlighted 8 key promises relating to your pocket should a party win power or end up in coalition after the election on the 12th of December. So do go to This Is Money for that in full. But just as in the 2017 poll, each manifesto covers Brexit, yet the outcome remains, of course, too uncertain to give any firm financial details. However, they do note if parties claim a benefit from either achieving or avoiding our departure from the EU, that is in it as well. So we'll go through that too. But don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. A very warm welcome to you both. But first, I think we're all united here in saying a very, very big thank you to the loyal listeners of This Is Money podcast. We had a good October, didn't we, Simon?
We did. We had a very good October. Yes, we had more than 100,000 listens for the first month. So that's awesome. So if you're one of those listeners, thank you very much. And tell your friends and your family and just random people you meet in the street.
Exactly.
So that it keeps going up.
Thank you very much for the listeners. Thank you, Simon. I thought we'd start on a high and see where it takes us. Eh? So, Lee, should we crack on with the Conservatives? Because we mentioned last week, didn't we? We had a bit of a teaser from the Lib Dems and from Labour, but we're going to go fully into it now. But the one that we didn't have until this moment, the chair was empty, one might suggest, but it's filled now, was the Conservative Party.
Yeah, we haven't got a block of ice in here slowly melting in the studio, Georgie.
We do
unfortunately,
not.
We don't. Yes, we've got the Conservative manifesto. It snuck out last weekend with the mantra "Get Brexit done," which I've had a couple of times through my letterbox as part of local local campaign from my MP. "Get Brexit done" is the manifesto pledge. It's a lot slimmer than the Labour and the Lib Dem manifestos. It's almost the 2017 election in which Theresa May had what one could argue a disastrous campaign. Some of the things that got picked up in that manifesto, I think the Conservative Party were keen to keep this a very kind of steady as she goes. Yeah, slimline, nothing that could get too badly picked upon. But you could say with all the manifestos, Georgie, all of them are pretty pie in the sky. I would take it with the largest of large pinches of salt, all of these manifestos, because how some of this spending is going to be funded is another question. But, you know, the main part of the Conservative manifesto is, of course, to get Brexit done. And once that is done, you know, they're talking about ending the austerity that has been in this country really since 2010, since the financial crisis as well. It's kind of like a two-pronged approach, I would say. Get Brexit through the door, get it done, and then they'll start their programmes. And I think if the Conservative Party win, we've had some polling this week, you can't read too much about these polls because they've been woefully inaccurate in the past. But we had one quite influential poll that did accurately predict the 2017 outcome. It was one of the only ones that did, the MRP, which is a YouGov poll, which is suggesting a 60-odd seat majority for Conservative Party. As I said, it's still a couple of weeks ago, so who knows whether that's going to be right or wrong. But if they do get into power, Brexit does get done, I think we will see a lot more get announced this year. So it's not an all singing, all dancing manifesto. Most of it we had anyway, the main sort of meat and bones of what they were talking about doing. One of which, the main one, is to raise the national insurance threshold. It would mean basically a personal allowance that starts at £12,500. That was quite a leaked thing, I would say. It was out there. It wasn't anything that kind of made us go, wow. We've had a few other bits and pieces. I mean,
we have to ask Lee, though. Sorry, you did mention the 2017. So I feel like I should go back there a little bit and say, Really, is there anything that's... What else can you add to that manifesto? It wasn't a million years ago. It was only 2 years ago.
Yeah, but...
Is there anything massively new in this one that wasn't perhaps...
Yeah, well, you've got to think that 2017 manifesto...
I'll tell you one thing that isn't in there, the disastrous policy on social care.
The social care was where it all fell apart. Yeah. So that's what they were kind of... What I was trying to allude to in that was that they were keen not to have any of those kind of disastrous.
Oh no, I understand that, but a lot of the sort of tax measures and all those sort of things you would imagine have always been there, have been ideas that we've known for some time.
Well, I think the most important point with the Tory manifesto, and if you look at the differences in what the three main parties say they're going to do with public spending, it looks like the Tories are going to increase public spending by much, much less, because their manifesto promises an extra $3 billion versus Labour's $83 billion and the Lib Dems' $30 odd billion. But the really important thing is that the government has already announced plans for day-to-day spending to rise by £34 billion a year by 2024 before the election manifesto came out. So when you're looking at the manifestos, that $34 billion isn't in there. They've already said they're going to do this. That's the bit where Boris Johnson's Conservative Party has effectively disowned David Cameron and George Osborne and Theresa May's Conservative Party. And he said, we are reversing austerity. So the $3 billion a year, yeah, actually, there's not that much in the manifesto, but they've already announced a lot of stuff already. So there's things like this 50,000 nurses. Now, they said there's going to be 50,000 extra nurses. There's been a big row about that as to what the word extra means, because 18,500 of them are going to be nurses who are convinced not to quit nursing.
Right.
Now, arguably, you do end up with 50,000 extra nurses, because if you were going to lose 18,500 and you keep them and then you add another 31,500, you still have 50,000 extra nurses. But in this day and age, you've got to argue about stuff. We're going to get an extra 5,000 GPs. They've already announced a load of extra GPs. I don't know where this magic doctor tree comes from and where all these people are going to come from. But there's things like that in there. And there are elements that have been, you know, already announced. But there is a very striking graph from the IFS that we put in one of our election manifesto roundups yesterday that show the absolute gulf in the spending plans between the three parties, as I alluded to earlier. So we've got an extra £2.9 billion of day-to-day spending from the Conservatives versus an extra £97.8 billion of extra day-to-day spending by the Labour Party. That includes the stuff in the manifesto and what they're talking about with the WASPI women, I think. And an extra £36.8 billion day-to-day spending by the Lib Dems. Investment spending, that's infrastructure stuff, that's bridges, roads, railways, all those other things. Extra £8 billion from the Conservatives. Extra £55 billion from Labour. And an extra £26 billion from the Lib Dems. So whichever one of these three parties gets in, and I think we can probably work on the basis that barring some amazing miracle, the Lib Dems are not going to be the majority party. Whichever of the other two get in, you're going to see spending rise by a lot. But if you get a Labour victory, you're going to see spending rise by an awful, awful, awful lot, which the IFS said takes us from about a third of the way up from the bottom in terms of day-to-day spending amongst major developed economies. So we spend more than lots of other countries, but we spend less than lots of others that are considered tax and spend countries, to about a third of the way down from the top. So we're still below a lot of those countries like the Scandinavian countries that we consider to be the tax and spend big state countries, but we'll be much closer to the top. The key difference that the IFS said is that we're going to try and do this by largely only taxing high earners, or Labour plan to do this by largely only taxing high earners, whereas those other countries have a much wider tax base. So more of the tax is soaked up by middle to lower earners, whereas in this country, the tax base has become increasingly concentrated over recent years.
That is an extraordinary difference in figures, though, isn't it, Simon? I mean, we'll go a bit more deep into Labour and sort of financing, but just how on earth do they make up such a big gap between the two as to how much money they're going to spend? Where is it going to come from?
Well, it's going to come from tax, according to Labour. And that's going to come from, as we discussed last week, they are going to raise income tax. So there's going to be a new super rate super rich rate, sorry, above £125,000, whether that counts as super rich is up for debate. There's going to be a new, the additional rate of 45p is going to come down to £80,000. There'll actually be a 67% tax rate before you get to the 51 because of the removal of the personal allowance. That takes away £1 of personal allowance for every £2 extra you earn. And that means that effectively you add 50% to the tax rate. So it goes up by half. So if there's a 45p tax rate at that level, it'll actually be 67.5%. But they've costed it. They've said where all this money's going to come from. The IFS looked at this yesterday and talked about how plausible it thought some of this stuff was. And it said that, for example, the income tax one, they reckoned that they could probably get most of that money in. It said that the corporation tax, they reckon they'll get an extra $24 billion from that. The IFS says probably less in the long run. Then you've got corporation tax sort of other, which is sort of getting rid of people dodging it and stuff like that. It's very difficult to achieve, it said. Financial transactions tax, Labour reckon they'll get $9 billion from this. The IFS says probably less. And then there's some big question marks over dividend tax and CGT, capital gains tax. So they're going to tax that as income. They reckon that'll bring in £14 billion. That's the kind of element where people can change their behaviour. Labour talked a lot about this. They put a very big document out funding real change, you know. So they've tried, fair play to them, they've tried to cost it. It's just whether you actually believe that stuff or not. And there's a lot of people who are saying, no, they're not actually going to be able to pull it off. Anti-avoidance is the really interesting one. This is the making the people avoiding tax pay tax. Now, there's been some fairly wild figures placed on this in the past by John McDonnell and Jeremy Corbyn. I remember at one point we were talking about, you know, nearly £100 billion or something like that they were going to get in. It's come down to only £6 billion now. They've got a lot more realistic on that one.
£6 billion still a
sizeable. It's still a lot of money. Yeah,
is that a plausible sort of figure, do you think, or is it just not quite as outlandish as the other one?
It's hard to put a figure on it, isn't it? Because of how much potentially goes on, you know, of that kind of thing that we don't, you know, register, that we don't know. There has been a crackdown.
There has been. So I don't think that it is plausible because what I see when I read the Labour manifesto and read the funding real change document, and I have actually bothered to read both of them. Mm. Not every single word, but I've probably given them a closer read than most people. They're quite long. And when I listen to the plans being outlined, is really a plan to go after what have been branded higher earners, but are really the low-hanging fruit of higher earners. They're the people earning, you know, £100,000 to £200,000 on PAYE. Or the people lower down the scale who maybe they're contractors and pay themselves and a bit of dividends and they roll up some money in the business and they use the entrepreneur's relief on capital gains tax to take some money out at the end of it. But they're not, we're not talking huge sums of money here. What I don't see is any pointed and credible plans to get the people earning the £500,000, a couple of £1 million a year to pay more tax. I don't really see the plans. I don't see anything when they talk about inheritance tax. They're going to bring the threshold back down to £650,000, getting rid of this own home allowance. What I don't see is any reflection on the report that the Office of Tax Simplification put out, which shows that the rate of inheritance tax you pay, the effective rate, goes up until you hit a couple of £1 million or so. And then once you start getting to the really, really rich people, it starts going down again. So it sort of goes up, humps, and then goes down. And this is the people buying up all the farmland to pass on, because farmland is exempt. This is the people passing on the estates. This is the really, really rich people, the really ingrained wealth in this country. And they pay a lower effective rate of inheritance tax than the merely very, very comfortable who probably what bumped them into it was an expensive house somewhere in London in the southeast. So I don't see any plans for that kind of thing. So then when I hear this stuff about the anti-avoidance, I'm just a bit sceptical, to be honest.
All right. So, Lee, we started doing some of the Conservative policies and things that affect the pound and pocket. We got to the national insurance threshold and all that. Mm-hmm. What else?
Potholes.
Potholes, yes, that's a big popular one, isn't
it?
You know,
it is.
Potholes are not popular, but sorting them out is popular.
It's one of those bugbears, isn't it, of people, oh, you know, when are they going to fix the potholes? But apparently, the Conservatives, I'm sure every budget have said that the pothole problem is going to be fixed. The trouble is, they can't fix the weather. So, I mean, you know, the pothole problem is going to continue.
When they should have fixed the potholes was when they announced HS2. HS2, if you remember rightly, was one of the things that was going to help us drag ourselves out of the mire of the financial crisis. And there was going to be this big infrastructure spend. And the reason why you spend big on infrastructure is it gets money into the economy, into the real economy, and helps get things moving. It's a stimulus. Mm-hmm. Except, of course, the only stimulus that HS2 has been is for overpaid consultants,
yes.
I think. what we should have done at that point is put the money into fixing potholes. And because that money, trust me, pretty much goes straight into the economy, because the people you pay to fix the potholes have a tendency to go out and spend their money. And the potholes haven't got any better since then.
Pothole economics.
All right, so potholes are in there.
I love it. As I said earlier, Georgie, it was quite light. They say they're going to keep the triple lock, which basically guarantees state pension rises of at least 2.5%. But that's pretty much what, you know, the other parties are saying. One thing that was quite interesting that's not in the manifesto, I've watched some of the leader debates. How much value there's been in those leader debates, I don't know, because I just sit there. I don't know about anyone else, but I just tear my hair out watching these leaders, thinking, wow, is this really the best we've got, these people in this room right here? But hey, it's what we've got and who we've got to vote
yes,
for.
Yes, indeed.
I think the whole last week, the whole WASPI situation was quite interesting. And when Boris Johnson was asked what, you know, his thoughts and views are, so the women against state pension inequality, where some women argue that they weren't told with enough time forward planning to plan for a rise in state pension age. My mum, for example, was affected, and it put her retirement plans back by quite a bit. She was upset about that scenario. I think she's calmed down a little bit now because it happened a couple of years ago, but it hit her quite hard.
Yeah.
And it meant she had to stay in work for longer than she'd anticipated. I think she was already dreaming of that state pension payment coming through. But Boris Johnson was asked, and he kind of did that Boris Johnson blustered his way through the answer of, I've got a lot of sympathy, but there's nothing that we're going to do about it. Now, Jeremy Corbyn, on the other hand, kind of came out and said, well, yeah, it has been unfair, and all these people, all these women, deserve to be paid back. Now, the estimate of how much that will cost is £58 billion, which is pretty sizable. Where that money's going to come from when we're talking about spending elsewhere, I mean, answers on the back of a postcard, really.
But we still got that pledge, didn't we, in the Labour manifesto?
We still got that pledge. Whether, if Labour did get in power, whether that pledge would stay concrete or not is another question, or whether it's just a look at a way of getting another vote segment. You know, people, women that might not have otherwise voted for Labour might sit back and think, well, actually, hold on a minute, I'm out of pocket 5, 10, 15, 20 grand, because they don't believe that they had enough warning for these pension rises. Other critics argue that they did have enough warning, and that actually this has been coming in. We're going to see state pension rise up to 67. It's going to raise up to 68 after that. It's a difficult one to balance. It shows how much state pension, and how much we all expect to have a state pension when we hit retirement age, which for us in the studio here is going to be late 60s. But what if the goalposts keep shifting?
Mm.
What if that is incredibly expensive? Yes, we all pay in our national insurance over the years, but, you know, it's bubbling away. And if we fork out £58 billion, I mean, I'm not saying it's right or wrong from a non-objective view, but where does that...
Without giving
that
the politicians
from?
You know,
someone
answer,
like Nicola Sturgeon,
difficult decisions have to be made.
Nicola Sturgeon from the Scottish National Party didn't say either way. She was very clever. She's been the one leader, I would say, in these debates where, you know, whatever your views of her, she's actually come across much better than anyone else, I would argue. And she kind of said that she supports the women, but not what she was going to do about it. It wasn't a kind of... It was more of a politician's answer rather than feel sorry for them, but no, or feel sorry for them, yes. It was very much sort of on the fence. You know, it was a good response, is what I'm trying to say. So I think that has become one of the big topics of this election just in the last week.
Simon, as I said, difficult decisions need to be made about things, but that Well, that sounds like the weasel politician answer. It really is. When you're talking about where money goes, people have to make choices. Is this one of the right ones?
Well, yes, and this was where one of the questions that Jeremy Corbyn got a bit stuck on when he was interviewed the other day by Andrew Neil, the interview that Boris Johnson is trying to dodge, which I think Boris Johnson needs to man up and get himself into that studio. Although I can see why he wouldn't, because the most he has to lose from not doing the interview is a couple of weeks of being called a chicken. The worst most he has to lose from doing the interview is a serious skewering. And I don't think anybody expects that he's going to go, he would go in, do that interview and come out of it thinking, oh, that went well.
Yeah. I'm sure I overheard you in the office, Simon, say the other day it was like watching Corbyn turn into a kebab and layers of him be stripped off. Or
no, I said that was what would happen to Boris. Yeah. So the question was, how are you going to fund this WASPI women thing? And some of it is, Jeremy Corbyn said, would come from government reserves. Andrew Neil pointed out that we don't have that kind of money in government reserves. Jeremy Corbyn said, we don't have to pay it all in 1 year. Andrew Neil said, well, we still don't have that money. And are you going to have to borrow the money? And after a long time of being questioned, Jeremy Corbyn did admit, yes, we will have to borrow the money. And that's the thing, right? So all of these expensive spending pledges effectively mean the country is going to have to borrow more money. Now, arguably, there are some things we should borrow more money for, because money at the moment is cheap. And that means that we can borrow money to invest and improve the country at very, very low interest rates. Other things, maybe we shouldn't be borrowing money for, and maybe we should still be concerned about balancing the books, because the idea of balancing the books that completely dominated the political debate over recent years seems to have somewhat gone out of the window. To move on to the Lib Dems, though, which I think is important to mention, is they did actually come out with what seemed like a reasonably credible and not unpopular plan to raise taxes in order to do something, which was to put an extra penny on income tax to help relieve the social care crisis and spend more on the health service. Now, if you speak to people in the social care and health world, they will tell you that we need more than that extra penny, but it's a start. It's still a penny. So, you know, you'd see rates go up to 21p, 41p and 46p. I don't think people would object that much to that. I think people would go, all right, yeah, OK, I can see there's a problem. We keep banging on about the problem. If we are going to continue with the free at the point of use health service with our ageing population, if we're going to sort out this social care system, then we probably need some more money. And if you're going to add an extra penny to my income tax and you promise it's going to go on that, then yeah, all right, I'll pay an extra penny. I think that's fine. They also want to abolish the separate idea of capital gains and remove the capital gains allowance and tax capital gains at income tax rates. Now, this is a bit where basically both the Lib Dems and Labour come slightly unstuck on this idea that this is only a tax on the rich, because there are a lot of small shareholders in this country, pensioners particularly, who have built up funds, shares, investment trusts and so on, and who would plan to sell those in order to help fund their retirement or get by. And if they were to sell them and make a sizable capital gain, they would see a big tax hike. The Lib Dem plans don't affect as many people as the Labour ones, because Labour wants to tax dividends in the same way. And there's a lot more pensioners, people who aren't rich, who use some of those dividends to supplement their income. I could see people starting to get big tax bills and be very unhappy about this one further down the line. I think this is the kind of thing where people think, oh, that's all right, yeah, okay, well, you know, I wouldn't probably make a capital gain and so on. And then all of a sudden, they come to sell some shares that they've held for the last 25 years and get hit with a tax bill that takes a sizable chunk out of them, you know, maybe 40%. And all of a sudden, they start to get a little bit grumpy. The other thing the Lib Dems are going to do is give local authorities the opportunity to massively increase council tax on second homes up to 500%, which is quite a lot, and a £10,000 skills wallet. This would see £10,000 given to every adult, spread across three instalments. You get £4,000 at 25, £3,000 at 40, and £3,000 at 55. You could top up the wallets. They could be spent on education and training throughout adulthood, and a range of training course providers would be monitored by the Office of Students, the Higher Education Regulator, and certified by the government. Estimated to cost £1.62 billion, be funded by an increase in corporation tax to 20% and those capital gains tax hikes I was talking about. I don't think that's necessarily a bad idea. I just don't know whether people would actually spend their £10,000 skills wallet. I think it have giving people a pot of money to spend on improving their training and education is a decent idea.
I really like that. If you don't spend it, they should go back and be spent to someone else.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you could claim someone else's.
Like,
actually spending yours, you could go claim someone else's who's not using it.
But surely...
you can't take it out. You can't do anything.
The likelihood is at 25, 40 and 55 that you'd be in employment, and surely the buck would fall a little bit on your employer to say, hey, how are we going to improve you to make sure, A, you're motivated to stay here and
with more
to
and more people
get
being
skills.
Freelance and stuff
yeah,
now
that's true.
And starting their own business and wanting to go and the fact we're having sort of more multi-phased lives, I think, is a better way, because like you said, you know, we in this room think we're going to have a state retirement at late 60s or something. We may not have a state pension.
You're going to need a side hustle instead of a state pension. Is that what you're saying,
exactly.
I'm going to be 70 sort of trying to make some money.
Side hustle, yeah.
Being a YouTube influencer or something. Is that it? And I need some skill. I need a skills
YouTube
wallet. I need a skills wallet to get me through that.
So this would be my concern, that an entire industry springs up that involved in removing money from people's skills wallet with overpriced and potentially quite useless things that they're teaching them. But then learning is learning, and there is an argument that learning for learning's sake is a good thing. I think it would have to be quite heavily policed in order to make sure that it didn't turn into a Wild West. And it's got one of those, it's one of those policies that has the hallmark of never actually coming to life because it gets completely torpedoed before it does. Anybody remember home information packs?
HIPs.
Yeah, that was the great plan to totally reform house buying, where the house seller was going to have to provide this pack. We were going to have a legion of home inspectors, in fact. That was a Labour plan under Gordon Brown and Tony Blair, and people were training up to be home inspectors. It was going to be a whole new sort of job stream for people, and then the whole thing just got completely sunk.
I'm going to stick with housing, actually, because I know that the Conservatives had this push for longer mortgages for first-time buyers. What else do the three parties have for...
Well, that's quite interesting, that Conservative, what you were saying there about the 30 years becoming more of the norm type thing and longer-term mortgage products, because I don't really quite get the point of it stepping in to an industry in which those decisions are being made by brokers, etc. anyway. And what we are finding are buyers to get through affordability checks stretching mortgages on for longer. Now, that does need to be looked at, because if people are starting to take out 35, 40-year mortgages, not digesting how much interest, extra interest that could mean compared to what was a traditional 25-year mortgage or even a 30-year mortgage, I can kind of understand the logic if that's what they're saying, that it shouldn't really go beyond that. But I think that some of the manifesto they were talking about, they were comparing it to the US and how the British property market, and how in the US they have longer-term mortgages. But we all know what happened in this financial crisis. I'm not sure how much I'd like to take advice from our American cousins when it comes to property and mortgage terms. And also the Conservative pledge, of course, to build, I think, was it 300,000 homes, which is something that they've spoken about, I think, pretty much.
Yeah.
I believe that's just the existing target.
I mean, that's just the existing target. That just
which they haven't
which
made.
They haven't. Mm. But what the trouble is with house building in this country is that you could argue that more homes need to be built, yes, but then where do they go is the big question. And you get a lot of NIMBYs, a lot of people, and rightly so, defend, you know, whereabouts they live, are saying it's already overcrowded, they'll build these homes, there won't be enough infrastructure going up, and there's all kinds of wranglings that go, you know, in and around towns across Britain, in which people already suffering from, you know, high levels of traffic, already suffering from a GP surgery that's not open enough, or it has too many patients, it doesn't have enough schools, it doesn't have enough services, it doesn't have enough buses, it doesn't have enough train capacity. All of these things don't help when you just then bung up 1,000, 2,000 homes somewhere. So I think we need to get a lot smarter in this country about that kind of thing. And the other parties, what would Labour pledge? They pledged to build way more than that, didn't they?
They pledged
$100 billion.
Yeah, there's a lot of affordable homes.
Affordable
homes, and also housing. Social housing. They want to build a new wave of council housing as well. The problem with the home building thing is that we have actually built quite a lot more homes in recent years. The new build home market has been very much stimulated by the sort of revival of the first-time buyer, falling mortgage interest rates and the Help to Buy scheme, which decided to solve the problem of houses being too expensive by bunging a 20% interest-free loan to the people buying them, which meant that houses didn't get any cheaper. In fact, they got more expensive, and house builders now make a larger profit on every one they sell. But it enables the first-time buyer to try to ignore that because they're getting a load of free money from the government, except it's not free. They've got to start paying it back after 5 years at a very low rate of interest. This is not a particularly sensible policy. However, it has been so successful in getting more homes built and being one of the few things getting more homes built, because people are not really convinced about buying new build homes because the housing industry hasn't covered itself in glory by building very good ones over recent years and managed to get itself embroiled in a leasehold scandal, is that we are now addicted to the drug of Help to Buy. Yeah. So we've got a real problem weaning ourselves off it. And the house building industry since the financial crisis has become increasingly concentrated. There's less small house builders, more of it is concentrated in the big house builders, who were described the other day in something I read as effectively an oligopoly. So this is the big problem with building more houses, is we just, as Lee said, we need a whole new plan and idea about how we're going to do it, that even not taken into the account of the current plan appears to be just expanding new towns. You know, so the really interesting thing, right, is if you go round the countryside. So I grew up in Hertfordshire, right, and the outskirts of a town. If you go around there, right, you've got your towns and you've got your villages, okay, which have been there for ages, and they obviously got bigger as you built more houses. But there's loads of places where you'll find effectively an estate. It's a fancy estate, you know, but it is effectively a housing estate. It, where in the 50s, but also largely the 60s, the 70s, you got like a few hundred houses just suddenly sprung up here or a few hundred there or something, created a whole new kind of little area. They weren't necessarily even on where a village was. They might be near to a village or near to a town or something. But I've never had anybody explain to me how this actually sort of occurred. How did they ever get permission to go, I know, let's build 500 houses here or 400 houses there kind of thing? And there was obviously a completely different way of thinking back then. And maybe we need to... And some of those houses, those places, they're quite successful. They're little neighbourhoods and everything. They're well-built houses. They're all on decent-sized plots, nice big gardens and everything. They're the kind of things that people want. Yeah, they're not necessarily affordable homes in the sense of affordable homes, but they were affordable at the time for normal families with, you know, decent jobs, reasonable amount of money. They weren't built as millionaires' rows. Many of them have turned into millionaires' rows now because we don't build houses like that anymore. But maybe we need to jump back quite a few years and go, well, what were they doing then that made them think we should do this? And maybe we should do a bit of that now, because if you take a flight somewhere, then you will see that very large parts of the country are not built on, even in the very overcrowded southeast of the country. And maybe we could find a bit of room right in the middle of the countryside to build some houses, as long as we connect it up properly with some proper bus services, off-road routes so that people can cycle or walk to the nearest place where there's a station or whatever. And I'm not a great advocate of building in the countryside, building on the greenbelt, things like that, because a lot of it that you see just leads to the sprawl of existing towns. It makes existing towns that are already big enough even bigger, changes the dynamic of them, changes the feel of them. But maybe we could find some new places to build, you know, a few hundred houses there, a few hundred houses here. Look back to what they did back then. Or maybe it was just a completely rubbish idea, but I don't see anybody ever talking about this.
Is there a long-term thing with that? Is it just because we just see too much tinkering and maybe we do need a bit more cross-party strategy forward thinking, which we're never going to get? But
well, yeah, I mean, that would be a sort of dream world, wouldn't it, Georgie, in which, you know, everyone's actually working together towards actually making Britain a better place to live and to succeed in, rather than what we've got at the
bung
moment,
another ISA,
which, oh god, yeah, that would be great, another ISA, wouldn't it, Georgie? We can only dream of that as well. But, you know, I'd like to think that next year maybe we will start seeing a kinder, gentler politics, in which, you know, perhaps the whole landscape would have changed and we will actually start doing something better. You know, maybe we'll be Brexit would have finally happened, or we finally take Brexit off the table.
And that's why we need to get Brexit done.
Yeah, as Boris would say.
But
you know what I'm trying to say. It's kind of I know your point there. You know what you're trying to say. But it, the last three or four years, politics has just been an absolute basket case in this country, hasn't it? It's been absolute mad. I mean, I've seen things in the last couple of weeks that, you know, it is. If I'd watched it in the thick of it, I honestly I would have been like, this is just too outlandish. That is the state of politics at the moment. It's just been, I genuinely believe that the last large majority of people just want what's best for this country. What that is, of course, is open to debate. But rather stop seeing all of this kind of, you know, absolute nonsense that's been going on. I mean, I would argue that Boris Johnson, for example, in the Conservative Party, would potentially be a lot more fearful if Labour perhaps had someone else other than Jeremy Corbyn as leader, for example, and would probably be, this would be a much closer battle, potentially. I mean, who knows? I'm not predicting. I'd be a fool to predict an election result because I don't know what's going
to
happen.
Sorry to cut in, but it does represent a very different choice in terms of the finances. So it represents
who they are.
People, you know, for many years have said, well, there's no real choice. They're all exactly the same.
Yep.
They are not, you know, like disregarding personalities and ideologies and all that other stuff. There is a very different choice to be made here between Labour's vision for a better socialist future and whether you think that that is a good idea or B, even if you did think it's a good idea, whether you think it's credible. And then whether you think they could pull it off, or the Tories' version of we're going to spend more money, we're going to reinvest in the country, we're going to do better, somehow Brexit's going to make us a more free trading, buccaneering, you know, prosperous country, or the Lib Dems somewhere in the middle kind of thing. But even their manifesto in terms of the extra spending is quite radical, but it's completely out-radicalised by the extremely long Labour list.
I take your point there, absolutely. One thing we will touch on, which took centre stage, I think, latter part of the week, was the future, the environment. Where do they sit on that?
I actually quite like the Labour plan to plant, was it 1 billion or 2 billion trees or something. It sounds crazy when you when you say it out loud, but a lot of trees, create a new national park. I love our national parks. I think they're fantastic places to be. I mean, how it would all work in
practice. It's very difficult when, if you're talking about building new homes,
talking about building
infrastructure
new homes.
And putting more trees
exactly, but
around the place.
One thing we could definitely not get away with, and it's a campaign that even, you know, the Daily Mail currently going through at the moment about planting more trees. We have seen a lot of our forestry, a lot of tree-lined streets, all of that kind of thing. We've seen all of those stories in which, you know, trees have been cut down from certain roads and all that kind of thing. I think that, you know, we should be looking at potentially, it's obviously been a hot topic in the last couple of years, but potentially creating a new national park, potentially putting more trees in place. But then I was watching the debate last night on the environment on Channel 4, and they, I forget his name, but they asked the leader of the Welsh Party, you know, but what would that do for farming communities, for example? And he couldn't really, you know, he was kind of, yeah, let's plant more trees. And then they asked about, but you know, you've got a lot of farming communities, are they going to be happy if you start bunging trees in the middle of farms? And he just couldn't really quite answer the questions. It's almost like it's been a bit of an afterthought tacked on some of this climate talk because of the way things have been in the last 12 to 18 months, in which we've had Extinction Rebellion that have helped put this climate cause, you know, rightly or wrongly, into the top of political agenda. I mean, even just to have a debate last night on mainstream television channel about the environment ahead of a major election, I thought was quite interesting, you know, of the way things are going. We've seen some other plans, which we talked roughly about last week, but the Lib Dems taxing people that frequently fly. I think that's something that's been spoken about quite a lot. I think we have a big problem in this country as well when it comes to transport. You know, we were joking around about HS2 earlier on in the show, but it's kind of we're in a kind of difficult place, I would argue.
In terms of transport, we've got the super bus networks that the Conservatives have announced.
Yeah, I mean, but the bus network, as soon as you get outside of London, well, no, I wouldn't. There is that comment where as soon as you get out of London, the transport network's rubbish.
I've spent most of my life outside of London, and it's not brilliant. In major cities, it's great.
No, it's not brilliant. I would say in my local area, which isn't a major city, it's just a normal town, I would say the bus service is fine.
Yeah,
I use it from time to time. I've never really. It's all connected everywhere up together. You know, relatively small towns. But you go rural,
yeah.
You know, a lot of my family live in Devon. I've seen the Devon bus network. Wow. I mean, there's no point of having a timetable. I mean, maybe things have changed since then. But there are parts of the country in which it's just not economical or viable to take what could be greener modes of transport. So I think we have to start looking at, you know, how we can improve that, how we get more, you know, economical buses on the roads and all that type of thing. There's been a lot of talk about how bad diesel is, for example, especially in city centres, how many deaths it is linked to.
Mm-hmm.
What can be improved in that way?
Yep.
And I think transport is one of the big ones. And then, of course, Heathrow, new runway, third runway. What's going to happen with that? That's been quite quiet over this manifesto period, I would say, in the run-up.
Simon?
The discussion about the environment is obviously very much focused on carbon and net zero, what year we go net zero in, and so on, and how we shift. So the bulk of the world's carbon emissions come from some form of energy use. Britain is in a fantastic position for the push into renewable energy, and we should be backing that. We are a world leader in offshore wind. We derive a surprising amount of energy from solar, and I think we should be doing everything we possibly can to go down that route. And all of the parties have different plans, but they're all sort of singing from the same hymn sheet in that. To go back to the stuff around the environment, talking about the Welsh leader and Wales, I mean, trees are really important because, firstly, they help capture carbon to combat climate change, but also they help to deal with some of the problems that we're facing because of the impacts of climate change. They help with the adaptation element. So we've just seen floods, immense floods. Now, one of the problems with the increased flooding is deforestation. It's the lack of trees. It's the lack of trees in the uplands. So in the uplands, when the rain comes, what you need them to do is to soak up as much water as possible and then to release the water as gradually as possible. The more trees that you remove, the more of that land that turns into very tightly grazed grass by sheep, the more the water just runs off that land, forms new rivers, goes straight into the other rivers, into the streams that then go into the big rivers. One of the really important things that you can have in rivers that helps stem the flow, slows it down, so when you get those large amounts of water, you don't get the flooding further down, is beavers. Beavers are really, really important for this, and there's projects to reintroduce beavers into various parts of the UK. And if you want to learn about this, I recommend you read a book called Wilding by Isabella Tree, and also George Monbiot, who I disagree with on an awful lot of stuff politically and ideologically, but is a very, very, you know, well-informed, good thinker on the environment. His book, Feral, which again talks about rewilding, and he wrote this Land for the Many report for the Labour Party. So they do actually have people thinking about this. But, you know, there is a wealth of evidence that shows things like trees, maybe going, yeah, of course, sheep farming is hugely important to Wales, okay? But you can share, okay? It doesn't need to be that the sheep is placed above all else, you know? You can keep the sheep farmer to be very important, but you just need to take more of that land and you need to try and make it so that it is the custodianship of it is better, and that means that we can then adapt better to dealing with climate change, and also we can try and suck up a bit more carbon. Things like regenerative farming. There's already a lot of stuff going on with farmers, for example, being encouraged to grow out their hedgerows. So rather than cropping them back, they grow them out. That's better for wildlife. It's also better for more trees, more bushes, all that kind of stuff. So there's loads of stuff going on about that. And someone who was also really, really hot on this is Michael Gove, who was the Environment Secretary, I believe. That was his title. And has now shifted off to some strange job title to do with Brexit. But he was really hot on this, and he put out a very credible plan as to what we could do post-Brexit in terms of rewarding farmers, not just for having massive farms or industrial farming or producing huge amounts of grain that we don't need, but for actually looking after the countryside and looking after the environment. And to the extent that he was praised by George Monbiot, a man who probably stands almost directly on the opposite end of the political spectrum to Michael Gove. But it's the kind of thing; those are the kind of things we need to be talking about, and we need to be thinking about, because you know the environmental stuff, the climate change stuff, the looking after the countryside, the looking after the planet, the looking after the your backyard stuff. It's not just about other countries and other parts of the world; it's about what we can do here. Because it will mean that we don't get things that are as bad as the floods that we've just seen.
I was just going to add to that. In my, just to go back to the environment and to the housing issue, they're putting up a big housing development close to where I live. And it's where a farmer has sold off some farmland. So, you know, he's cashed out on this bit of land. And part of this parcel of land was almost like a wild woods. It's just been chopped down. It's been chopped down probably about 6 months ago, 9 months ago. Nothing's happened since, but it's been chopped down ready. I drove past it last weekend after some rain. The whole place is like a floodplain. It's an absolute floodplain. And I looked at it and I thought, are you seriously thinking about buying a house here when everywhere else around it is already just surrounded in concrete? This parcel of land is probably vitally important to stop things like flooding and for environmental issues. And another thing I've touched on what Simon just said there, we do, not everyone, but I do feel like there are a sort of parcel of people that will go, well, you know, it's all well and good us trying to improve the environment here, but what about countries like India or China, which they've got 1 billion people in them, and they don't care. You know, they're creating all of this pollution. So what can I do as one single person, you know, in a country which perhaps doesn't produce as much pollution as those countries, well, doesn't produce as much pollution in those countries, and has gone quite a way, I would say, in recent decades to go renewable. But it's one of those subject areas where I think it's not about preaching to tell people what they should be doing, but more just, you know, just do the right thing. It's not complicated. And if you don't change what you're doing yourself, then no one's ever going to change. And, you know, it's just not the right mentality, in my opinion. Sorry, the election manifesto chat's gone to beavers and
environmental.
But it's about thinking ahead. People support this kind of stuff because, you know, whether they are climate activists, just think we should do something about it, or completely sceptical on that front, and people are entitled to their views. Most of them agree with the fact that we should probably look after the place that we live a little bit better and can look around us and go, we've not been doing an awesome job of that. And it's a lack of forward thinking. I mean, for example, at the moment, the water companies are sucking the chalk streams in this country dry, which are a fairly unique natural habitat, because they tap into the aquifer to take the water. Because the last time we built a new reservoir in the southeast of England was the 1970s.
Wow.
I mean, that's just
an education
mental,
this podcast, isn't it? I mean, honestly, this is just fascinating chat. We could go down for a very long time on this. There's lots to get through, however slimline the Conservative manifesto is.
I thought you were going to say the rabbit hole, Georgie, but I was going to say I'm not sure if there's any left.
No. I won't go there. But it is just a reminder that for more detail on this, please do go on to thisismoney.co.uk. I'm just looking at at how this article has been compiled, the number of people that have worked on it. You've really all pulled together, so really well done to all of the team that have worked to go through these manifestos, so we don't have to, but by all means, you can if you like to. But before I close this up, is there anything else in there that perhaps we should be thinking about? Anything else that's perhaps a bit quirky? Anything else? I mean, it's not quirky, but I'm thinking the things for parents, childcare, those sorts of things.
Almost all of them have promised lots more to free childcare and to support parents. I'm trying to think of anything really quirky in there that we haven't covered, to be
apart
honest.
From beavers.
I think the other thing that people should do is come and look at our report on the other parties' manifestos. So we've looked at the SNP, we've looked at the Green Party, we've looked at the Brexit Party, which doesn't have a manifesto because manifestos are lies, according to Nigel Farage.
Right.
The word came from the Greek or Roman word to lie. And so what he's done is he's got a contract with the British people.
That he signed with a big pen, like a novelty check.
Like the Edstone thing, is it? Like one of those? Did he grave it in...
Oh, no. I forgot about the Edstone.
Do you know what? I miss the more innocent days of the Edstone. Don't you?
I really miss those days.
I do. That was, you know, we thought things were a little bit tense and a little bit heated and a little bit nasty back then. I was pre even the Brexit vote.
Yeah.
Bring back the
I repeat my dad's oft-used phrase, which is, there is no situation so bad that it can't get worse.
I thought you were going to say his phrase, there is no situation so bad that it doesn't call for an Edstone.
That might be a new one. That's a new one there.
Also, think about, I mean, the worst thing that Ed Miliband did was eat a bacon sandwich funny. I mean, that feels like a different era now, doesn't it? That just, you know, man eats bacon sandwich. It's just, I don't know. Just...
Boris Johnson denies eating bacon sandwich whilst eating bacon sandwich. Jeremy Corbyn refuses to say how bacon sandwich will be paid for. Joe Swinson says, we'll send the bacon sandwich back even if we want it.
On that note, well done to all of the team who did all of the work on that. Thank you very much to you, the listeners. You can keep up to date with all the latest Breaking Money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. If you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you would like them to look into, Simon,
email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk, tweet us @thisismoney, or come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all podcasts past and join in the debate in reader comments.
Do indeed. And if you like the podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.